world's longest commercial flight is back in action. The 19-hour ultra-long-haul non-stop Singapore Airlines marathon from Singapore to New York. The first flight taking off on Thursday after 5 years out of action. It's going to be a major boost for the Asian airline, which is about to have its biggest US footprint ever.
Mexico's OXXO, a convenience store retailer, sells everything from snacks to beer and batteries. Now, this old-school chain has also found a sweet spot for itself in Mexico's online shopping market.
A third of Japanese companies now say they're feeling the heat from Trump's trade war with China. That figure from an anonymous Reuters poll soaring from just 3% in May, as a growing number of companies become collateral damage to the fallout between the world's two biggest economies. 40% of the companies surveyed said they thought the trade conflict could disrupt supply chains over the next 3 years.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Wednesday. It's October the 17th, and it's 5:10 in the morning. Thanks for being here with us for another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. We've put together a really good broadcast for you today. First up, Cecilia Reyes will be here from the Chicago Tribune. Same city, different opportunities. You may have seen this report in the Chicago Tribune about the different outcomes for children from different Chicago neighborhoods. We're going to dive into that this morning in our first segment. And a little bit later on, at about 5:40 this morning, Heather Long will be here from the Washington Post, economics reporter at the Washington Post. We're going to be talking about some processing changes for chicken plants and the overall economy as well with Heather. So stay tuned for that again at 5:40 this morning. First, though, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank market desk with some of the numbers from around the world. We'll begin in Europe this morning with markets are mixed. DAX in Germany is lower by about 0.5%. London markets are higher by about 0.25%. And in France, markets are higher by just a fraction. In Europe, or rather Asia, the Nikkei is going to end the day down just over a percent, close to a percent and a third, 291 points. The Hang Seng is going to be up just a fraction. The Shanghai up about 0.5%. And in the United States, futures are pointing toward opening losses a little bit later on Wall Street. Dow futures are down 87 points. That's almost a third. The NASDAQ and S&P futures off a 0.25% to a third this morning. And oil is trading at $71.65 a barrel, which is down about 27 cents, the New York crude. This morning, we have a couple of stories before we begin this morning. One of them involves oil prices. International benchmark crude up 36 cents a barrel. That number at $81.77. West Texas crude, which we're watching, is at $72.27. Now at $71.65. Prices rose yesterday after an announcement that U.S. crude stockpiles fell by 2.1 billion million with an M barrels last week. Industry analysts predicted an increase of 2.2 million barrels. Yesterday on Wall Street, the stocks surged as strong earnings. A number of Dow components reported strong earnings. The Dow up nearly 548 points. And housing starts for September are due today. The housing industry analysts are forecasting a retreat from August's numbers. The experts are forecasting housing starts coming in at an annual rate of 1.2 million last month, down from more than 1.28 million in August. Housing starts coming at 7:30 Chicago time this morning. Front and center this morning, we all know that our city's neighborhoods have rich histories and diverse populations, but new research suggests that life could be harder for a child in one neighborhood compared to another just a few miles apart. Cecilia Reyes is a reporter at the Chicago Tribune and is with us this morning. Cecilia, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
What is the biggest finding, do you think, from this report? It's all pretty significant, but what would you say is the big takeaway?
Yeah, so what these researchers did at Harvard, Brown, and the Census is take a look at a lot of tax information and join it with census information. So they have income data and they have demographic data. And I think the biggest contribution their research, which has been ongoing for the last years, has made has been in the realm of how they defined upward mobility, which is if you're coming from a household from parents who are making money in the lower 25% of the population, and you make it to the top 20% nationwide. So if you come from a lower end of the financial background, and you make it to the top 20%, they found some pretty big gaps between races, most notably between white children and black children. And this gap, I think, is kind of what they've been focusing on when reporting on what it means to have opportunity in different parts of the country.
And people get the chance to head over to ChicagoTribune.com. We'll link out to the story as well, but they've put together, and there's a link there for the Opportunity Atlas, an interactive map of some of the various outcomes. I think it's interesting that they chose to look back at folks who were born between 1978 and 1983. Why pick that generation, that group of people?
That's right, yeah. So what they say is that historically they're better able to understand how the outcomes of children came about when they look at the characteristics that they were that they had when they were being raised. They say that in some ways, looking back at historical data that is now basically 30 years old, if not more, is more accurate than, say, looking at if you live in a high poverty neighborhood or something like that. I think they specifically chose this window not just because they would be able to have a more full understanding of, okay, there were children then and now they're adults, but because the tax data, I think, began to be able to be linked back sometime in the 90s. So,
yeah. So that makes a lot of sense. We're talking a lot about general economic incomes, that sort of thing. But they really looked at things to come to their conclusions or come to the data, incarceration, rates of incarceration, teen pregnancy, all of those things. Talk to us a little bit about those and some of the things that are impacted in a child's life.
Yeah, so they had a lot of outcomes besides how much money the children were making as adults. They, for example, were able to figure out how many of the children that started out in the survey as children were incarcerated or behind bars at the time of the 2010 census. So this was a snapshot of how many of the children that they started studying were now behind bars. That, I think, has been one of the most glaring findings of the study as well, besides the upward mobility, because, at least in Cook County, there were nearly 1 in 10 black children who are now adults who turned out to be incarcerated in some way in 2010. They also looked at teen pregnancy rates, that's right, they were also able to break down income levels, not just for the household, but for the individual. They looked at how many people stayed in the same place that they grew up in or in the same metropolitan area in the same city. So they try to bundle as many outcomes as they could from the very rich data set they had.
We're on with Cecilia Reyes this morning, reporter at the Chicago Tribune, talking about a new study mapping the lives of children from Chicago neighborhoods and the outcomes those children have now had as adults. Cecilia, I think one of the important parts of the story is that, the experts are saying this isn't the neighborhoods necessarily that have failed these children. It's something bigger. They didn't really talk about the why about all of this. But what are they telling you about what this study shows and what kinds of changes might be able to be made?
That's right, yeah. So the researchers were very careful to not draw any causal conclusions behind with their research. They say that they're not exactly sure you know, what is it about this part of the city or that other part of the city that is yielding these good outcomes for children? What they do say is that we should be able to at least focus policies so that we do study more carefully what sorts of either more targeted policies have been in place in the past that have helped children, or decide to develop something along those lines. I think people were very careful to try to not immediately say the conclusion was, well, we should try to move people around, but instead try to figure out how to make places more equitably distributed in terms of this opportunity.
Is there a fear here, too, that this will further pit one group against another, one neighborhood against another? Is that sort of the kind of target that we're putting on this?
I mean, I don't think so. I think the research has shown that it's not necessary. I mean, even within neighborhoods, there are a lot of differences. Like, one of the researchers we spoke with was talking about persistent poverty throughout parts of Chicago, and what he's saying is that, you know, you can kind of guess what the what a map of outcomes would look like in terms of income or some other measure, just because the city of Chicago tends to be very clearly divided by race. But even within those areas, it's not like they all are the same or they all look and have had the similar outcomes for children in all parts of it.
The other part of it, too, obviously, and we've been talking about it, is the race part of this, the racial part of this. Are researchers talking to you about why that seems to be getting the most attention from this research?
They wanted to be careful. I think the Opportunity Insights team has tried to pin down some of the reasons behind children's outcomes on whether the neighborhood that they were in was more racially integrated or people were more tolerant. But other researchers kind of cautioned that we should really wait to have more data to go in that realm or to go in that direction. I think because they think that there may be other factors at play that could be able to explain these differences that don't come down to racial animus.
Yeah, and poverty is the biggest among those. And looking at one of the maps now, for instance, from Lincoln Park, poor kids from Lincoln Park had no big boost either from their upward mobility. Obviously, the area was gentrifying at that time, but it still was one of the more upwardly mobile neighborhoods, so that's a significant finding.
Yeah, definitely. I think when we spoke to researchers about it, they were kind of careful to be hedging their conclusions on whether gentrification proved to be a good or bad thing, just from this one example. But it's definitely an area that people are looking into, whether people coming in with bigger pockets, if you will, cause the existing residents in that area to also benefit somewhat from that, or if it's just a matter of pushing people out.
What will the researchers focus on now? I know the project isn't complete. What are they going to be looking at as this moves forward?
I think cause is going to be a big thing. I think since they were starting this project and when they were talking to us about how localized they wanted to make it and how small they wanted to be able to see these differences, they were thinking more in terms of housing policies or specific school policies. I think in Seattle, for example, this data is already being used to try to target housing choice vouchers for people who want to move to some of these high opportunity places that don't have as high of rents as one may think. And I think, school choice is going to be a big thing as well.
Cecilia, we appreciate you being with us this morning. We're going to link out again to this story, and we will stay tuned, and we'd love to have you back to talk about this as this project continues.
Thank you so much.
Cecilia,
it's been great.
The Cecilia Reyes, a reporter at the Chicago Tribune, and again, we'll put the link not only on our Twitter feed this morning, but in the podcast of the Opening Bell a little bit later on this morning.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Wednesday edition of the Opening Bell. The Trump administration makes a change that will allow chicken processing plants to start operating at faster speeds. Some are concerned about what this might mean for consumers and workers. Heather Long is with us this morning, economics reporter at the Washington Post, by Heather Long on Twitter. Heather, good morning. Welcome back to the Opening Bell.
Hi, Steve. Good to be here.
I set this up by letting you answer the question about this, the part of this that's concerning workers and consumers. What's the fear here?
Well, this is a hugely controversial issue about how fast chickens should be slaughtered on the line and in a processing plant. And the big concern is safety. It's the faster that you move these lines, the more likely workers are to be injured, and the more likely something is to end up in a chicken, maybe that's damaged to not be inspected or taken off of the line when the chicken is damaged. So you worry that the end consumer might end up getting some meat that isn't so great.
Number is from 140 birds a minute on the line to 175. That's a difference of 35. Is that a big number?
Yeah, it doesn't sound huge. But again, the way that this works is in the chicken industry, you have in most of these plants, basically four inspectors. So four human beings whose job it is to sit there and watch these chickens be slaughtered and then visually inspect them right before they're slaughtered and right after they're slaughtered to make sure that everything looks okay. And so what you're doing is you're taking them from about looking at about 39 birds a minute to now looking at about 44 to 45 birds a minute. So again, it doesn't sound like a huge difference, but every extra bird is moving. now they're basically in a going to do an extra several, and they only have a second, maybe a second and a half, to look at these birds.
These plants would have to get a waiver from the USDA. How would they qualify for a waiver to be able to move at these faster speeds?
Yeah, so the process is pretty simple to get a waiver. At the moment, there's 25 plants out of about 200 in the country that have now obtained this waiver. And, basically you have to have a clean record for about 120 days. So if you haven't had a major safety violation for 120 days, you could pretty much get this waiver. The idea of waivers initially at the United States Department of Agriculture was to give a company or give a plant a break so that they could test new equipment or a new process. Every company is trying to get better technology and better processes in place. So the idea was, hey, we'll give you a break on a few rules for a couple of months or a year and see how things go. What really angers a lot of consumer and labor rights groups and animal rights groups is they're saying, look, now the Trump administration is going to give these waivers, even if there is no new process. There really isn't anything brand new happening here. It's just companies came to the Trump administration and said, hey, you're doing this regulatory rollback broadly in many industries. And, we've been arguing for years and we think we can process at faster speeds. So let's give this a try.
Your story talks to the National Chicken Council. They say that they have been testing this, I guess. There have been sort of a pilot program with the faster speeds. And they also talk about the international competition here. How important are those two things?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's kind of so there has been a pilot program with 20 plants. And that's been in place for several years now. It started under the Obama administration. Part of the issue is There isn't really a lot of data. Bizarrely, a number of those plants ended up not operating at the faster speeds. So I think a lot of advocate groups are like, look, you say we've got all this, supposedly got all this track record of what happens at 175 birds per minute, but when you actually ask for the data, there really isn't much data to be shared here. And it's also interesting on the international point, because at the moment, due to the tariffs that are in place that are going on with the trade fight between the United States and other countries, a number of countries have put tariffs in retaliation for President Trump's actions on U.S. meat. So the United States actually has an abundance of pork and chicken and other meats that are just sitting in warehouses, basically cold storage facilities. This is not a time when you can sort of make the argument of, the United States needs to be exporting more meat, or that, United States consumers really can't get enough meat. There's so much demand. In fact, quite the opposite is happening. We have too much meat on the market, and prices have been falling pretty steeply in the last few months. So it's just a really interesting time for the administration to be doing this.
And this comes after, if I'm correct, that the pork industry already started moving up its production rate faster. Is that correct?
Well, they're sort of going in tandem. The administration hasn't made the final rule on hog slaughtering, but they made a proposal earlier this year that really raised a lot of eyebrows, that they would do away with speed limits entirely on the hog lines. So there was, companies could run as fast as they want. And so there was concern that they might do the same thing with chicken. They didn't. They did keep a speed limit in place, partly because there was so much outcry. There were over 100,000 comments on the notion of trying to get rid of speed limits entirely in chicken facilities. So it's probably just a matter of weeks before the final hog and pork processing rule comes out, but the final rule is not out yet for hogs.
And we'll be watching closely as this moves forward to how this impacts the workers. But back to that part of it, I was just surprised to see that the typical worker in one of these plants makes about $25,000 per year. So the Labor Department, I'm guessing, is going to be watching this closely to see how this works or not.
So that's kind of the big question mark here. Is the United States Department of Agriculture has authority over these hog and chicken processing lines and how fast they can operate. But the argument from the USDA is our remit and our expertise is not worker rights. So the worker rights and what's happening to the health and safety of workers is supposed to be regulated by the Labor Department. And so that's where this is kind of an odd situation, where you have all these concerns that speeding up these lines is going to cause, particularly in this industry, more fingers to be lost, chopped off, or more problems with the upper body as people are moving their arms around really fast to process all this meat and cut all this meat up. And it's unclear how the Labor Department, are they going to put more inspectors? Are they going to monitor this? At the moment, we've heard nothing. There was no press release about these changes. As a matter of fact, they published this on September 28th in the midst of the Kavanaugh hearings. So there really doesn't seem to be a big plan in place for how there's going to be safety concerns are going to be addressed.
Heather, this all comes at a time when the chicken industry is getting some blowback from consumers. I don't know out there if you're seeing the ads, but we see them a lot here by the Humane Society about unhappy meals and the chicken McNuggets and conditions in factory farms. I'm guessing there's a potential here for, if we start seeing things go badly, more consumer blowback.
I think you're exactly right, and that's why consumer advocate groups are debating whether to file a lawsuit. I think they probably will about these faster line speeds. Again, there's just a feeling that if there were a real demand for these chicken and pork meats that wasn't being met, I think people might step back and say, okay, maybe we do need to run these line speeds faster to get more meat on the market. But at the moment, that is not the case. And I think people are rightly looking around and saying, why are we doing this at this particular moment in time when we already have a lot of meat on the industry, on the market shelves, and there are these concerns that have been raised. There's no doubt we've had the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, has done several audits of the meat, of the particularly chicken and pork industries, including one in 2016 and another audit in 2017. And they have said, the GAO has said, this is a nonpartisan group that audits all different parts of government and different parts of industry, and they've been very explicit that, yes, this industry has much higher illness rates, much higher safety violations, much higher problems with severe injuries. And that's been the case for a long time. The injury rates have been coming down in every industry, and that does include meat slaughtering. But there are some real safety concerns with this industry.
All right, Heather, good stuff this morning. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Steve. Bye.
Heather Long, economics correspondent at the Washington Post. We'll link out to her story there as well from WashingtonPost.com. And make sure you follow Heather on Twitter at @ByHeatherLong.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward a weak open on Wall Street a little bit later this morning. Opening bell at 8:30 Chicago time. The Dow, NASDAQ, S&P futures all off about a third. Now, agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Soybean and corn futures slid yesterday on improving harvest weather in the Midwest and some profit-taking, a day after both of those commodities neared two-month highs, and wheat followed the weak trend after a choppy session. And as we take a look at those closing prices at the Board of Trade yesterday, pretty much a red screen. The December wheat contract down 1¾ cents a bushel. The December corn contract down 3 cents. And November soybeans down 7¾ cents a bushel. In livestock futures trade, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, February lean hogs higher for the day, up 25 cents a hundredweight. But the October live cattle contract down 75 cents. And the October feeder cattle contract down $1.15 a hundredweight. The wheat market maybe expected to get a little higher during the last part of this year. Wheat exports looking set for a strong second half of the 2018-19 season, when shipments from Russia are expected to slow down. Chairman of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's World Agricultural Outlook Board said that today at a meeting looking at the wheat situation in a London conference. Today, day number two of the Sunbelt Expo at Moultrie, Georgia. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Wednesday, October the 17th. A new report on U.S. crude oil inventories coming today. U.S. oil prices have been jittery in the past few days as tensions with Saudi Arabia build. We'll also get the minutes from the last Fed meeting. Those will be published at about 1 o'clock Chicago time. A big day for earnings. Winnebago plans to release earnings before the opening. Alcoa will report after the close. Also today, Abbott Laboratories, Northern Trust Corporation, U.S. Bank Corp. And also this morning, we'll see earnings from M&T Bank and ASML Holding, NV80R. So a couple of things that could move the markets as we move forward this morning on Wednesday, October the 17th.